Welcome to a series of netcasts brought to you by Yale University.
On October 5, 2013, former Secretary of State Hillary Rodham Clinton received the Yale Law School Alumni Association Award of Merit. The event coincided with the Yale Law School's Alumni Weekend, during which Secretary Clinton celebrated her 40th reunion with fellow Yale Law School classmates. The following podcast includes Secretary Clinton's remarks during that award ceremony. She reminisces about her time as a student at Yale Law School and the experiences that sparked a lifelong passion about children's welfare.
Thank you, Dean Post, for those much too generous words, but that walk down memory lane that you just provided me. I also want to thank President Salovey. Thank you very much as well, Mr. President, and everyone at the law school and the university for this extraordinary honor. It has gone to many lawyers and leaders who I respect and admire, including the one I am married to. So I am deeply humbled to stand in their company. I also want to acknowledge Senator Dick Blumenthal, who is here. I thank you so much, Dick, and your family. And keep up the good fight on behalf of the people of Connecticut. I'm also told that former Senator John Danforth is here, and I wanted to acknowledge him and thank him for his years of leadership and stewardship. I look out at this audience and I see so many friends and colleagues. I could keep you here for many hours telling you stories, only if you swear not to take them out of the room. But I want to acknowledge Harold Coe. Yes, he was your former dean. He was also my State Department legal advisor. And Harold and I had a lot of adventures over the past 4 years, from negotiating the freedom of a blind Chinese dissident to co-starring in a photo that became a viral internet sensation. Now, the meme was called Text from Hillary, but Harold is right there with me. Depending upon the angle, his eyes are either open or shut. But I understand that he's thinking of capitalizing on his newfound celebrity by teaching a class called Texts from Harold, Statutes in 140 characters or less. If anyone could do it, Harold could. Now, just out of the frame of that photo on the C-130 is Jake Sullivan, class of 03, who is also here celebrating his 10th reunion after 4 years and nearly a million miles by my side at the State Department. Jake is now National Security Advisor to Vice President Biden. So if Vice President Biden starts wearing pantsuits and scrunchies, I think we know who to blame. But I greatly appreciate all of you who have been part of the journey that Bill and I have been on, most particularly the class of 1973, our friends and colleagues, and also some from 72, which is where I started. It is really hard to believe, as I look at some of the students in the audience, that it's been 40 years. I remember the first time I arrived on campus in 1969, I was driving a beat-up old car. I had a mattress tied to the roof. I was wearing my bell-bottoms, and I'm so grateful there was no internet or phone cameras in those days. I was, as Dean Post said, one of 27 women out of 235 law students. There was a camp set up in the square at the law school, the common. It was not quite clear what it was for, but it seemed to fit right in with the mood of the time. It was a tumultuous time. in America, in New Haven, and at Yale. And the students were drawn in. We had a lot of late-night heated arguments over the future of the country. We even challenged each other whether going to law school at such a time was a morally defensible choice. In other words, were we selling out? What would we do with the rest of our lives? Thanks to the steady leadership of President Kingman Brewster, who suspended classes during the worst of the unrest and opened the dorms to anyone who needed a meal, there was on the campus at least some feeling that we could get through this together. Those were the days of Reverend William Sloan Coffin, one of the most articulate voices of the anti-war movement. The law school dean, Dean Lewis Pollack, urged us to organize student patrols after the International Law Library was actually set on fire. And I remember being part of the Bucket Brigade, trying to save those priceless materials. So the times themselves certainly left indelible memories, but it was my professors and my classmates who most influenced me and shaped the kind of lawyer I became and the choices that I made. I took fascinating, challenging classes. I made a lot of friends, and one day, cutting through what was then the student lounge with some of those friends, my second year, I heard a voice say, "And not only that, we grow the biggest watermelons in the world." I grew up outside of Chicago. I said, "Who is that?" And the answer was, "That's Bill Clinton. He's from Arkansas, and that's all he ever talks about." So I was curious. Those were the days when he looked like a Viking from Arkansas. And we kept kind of looking at each other. You know, I'd walk by on the street or in the hallway, and I'd look at him, and he'd look back, but we'd never been properly introduced. So one day in the law library, I was looking at him, and he was looking at me. We were both supposed to be studying, of course. So I got up, and I walked over, and I said, "If you're going to keep looking at me, and I'm going to keep looking back, we at least ought to be introduced. I'm Hillary Rodham. Who are you?" Now, you know, Bill tells a much better story. He says, "Well, I totally forgot my name." But he quickly recovered, and we had a conversation that started that day and has continued to this one. I want just briefly to share a few of the lessons that I learned outside of the classroom that continue to influence how I see the world and the challenges facing our country. Now, it was here, as Dean Post referenced, that I developed a lifelong passion about children's welfare. And I learned that if you want to know about the moral, economic, and social health of a community, look at the children. It all began with a little flyer on the law school bulletin board outside the registrar's office. Now, I haven't been over there on this trip, so I don't know if there are still those flyers, but we used to study them like we were studying the Talmud, because you never knew what you'd find on that bulletin board. You might find a note saying, "Would anyone like to take a course next year about the legal, ecological challenges of the Central African forest?" I mean, that was Yale. And there was always somebody willing to teach it and to take it. Well, that day, I saw a little note about a woman named Marion Wright Edelman who was going to lecture on campus. I had just read about her in Time magazine. She was a 1963 graduate of the law school and the first African-American woman admitted to the Mississippi bar. She was a lawyer for the NAACP in Jackson. She was a friend of Dr. King and Bobby Kennedy. She was an altogether remarkable person. So I went over to hear her speak, and I was captivated. She talked about the political importance of taking care of kids, and why she, as a Yale Law School graduate, was focused on starting a Head Start program in Mississippi, how she wanted to use her Yale education on behalf of poor children. Something just clicked with me, and I went up to her afterwards, and I said, I really want to come to work for you this summer. And she said, that's great, but I have no money to pay you. And I was paying my way through law school, and I had to make some money, so I went back to the registrar's office and started looking around for something that could pay my way, and I discovered the Law Student Civil Rights Research Council gave out grants. So I applied for one, and I got it. And because of that, I was able to spend the summer of 1970 researching the plight of children of migrant farm workers who often lived without the basics of housing and sanitation. It was an eye-opening experience, and I returned to Yale that fall with a new sense of focus and mission. I had two professors, Jay Katz and Joe Goldstein, who encouraged my interest in how the law could better protect children and families and suggested that I spend time at the Yale Child Study Center. So I began to do so, attending case discussions, observing clinical sessions, getting to know the incredible Dr. Sally Provence, a pioneer in early childhood development, who helped stressed out parents understand that talking and reading lovingly to your babies, even when they were far too young to talk to you, would have lasting benefits. And this was before all the brain science. This was just understanding the absolute imperative of human connections with our youngest people. That insight really was driven home to me when I started consulting with the medical staff at Yale New Haven Hospital about child abuse. Child abuse was just being recognized as a problem in the early 1970s. I accompanied doctors on their rounds. I was just a law student, but I was interested, so they treated me like I knew something, and I would be asked, well, so what do we do? What's the law on this, and is there any law that we should be consulting? I saw children who'd been beaten and burned, who'd been left alone for days in squalid apartments, who didn't get the medical care they needed in a timely way. And I remember one father who brought in his badly injured 3-year-old, claiming that he had to beat the boy to get the devil out of him. Now, I'm sure there was child abuse and domestic violence when I was growing up, but I didn't see it. And it wasn't covered in the press, so it was a hidden, silent problem like so many others. And I began to see how the health and well-being of children was a real window into the health and well-being of our country. Kids were the canaries in the proverbial coal mine. And if you want to understand, even today, how economic dislocation of the past dozen years has affected American life, look at our children. More than 16 million American kids live in poverty today, the highest percentage since the early 1990s. Nearly half of all recipients of food stamps are children, 22 million of them. And yes, the overall poverty rate here in New Haven is just over 25%, but for children, it's nearly 38%, and in Hartford, Connecticut, it's more than 50%. Just think about that for a moment. Connecticut is one of our wealthiest states, and more than half the children in its capital live in poverty. If you want to understand our health challenges, many of which are correlated to economic troubles, look again at our children. The prevalence of chronic conditions like obesity, asthma, behavioral, and learning problems among American children has more than doubled in the past two decades. And despite all of the advances that we have made, babies in America today are more likely to be born underweight and undernourished than they were in 1990. If you even want to understand the human costs of political brinksmanship and gridlock in Washington, look at the children. Because of the government shutdown, nearly 9 million women and children will soon be unable to buy healthy food and baby formula through the special supplemental nutrition program for women, infants, and children. Already, nearly 19,000 low-income children younger than 5 can no longer attend Head Start programs, and that's on top of the 57,000 children who have been turned away because of the sequester. So if you really want to understand what this means when we talk about growing inequality and shrinking social and economic mobility that is undermining America's ideal of equal opportunity for all, look at the children. I was very struck by the important new research coming from Robert Putnam. He finished his PhD in political science here at Yale when I arrived for law school. He later earned acclaim for his work on the changing nature of America's civic engagement and community networks in his seminal study called Bowling Alone. Now, Dr. Putnam is studying today how economic pressures on parents translate into less time and support for kids who start off behind and struggle to catch up. In the 1960s and 70s, parents with different income and educational achievement levels were all spending similar amounts of time reading to their children. But over time, a gap emerged. Dr. Putnam and his team have looked at what they call diaper time, when parents address the immediate needs of their young children, and they've also looked at what they call goodnight moon time, when they talk, read, and interact with their kids. I love this because that book was very big at our house. Now, the research shows that everyone does diaper time. You have to. Or the very least that will happen is the baby will keep crying. But parents with lower income, less education, who struggle to work two jobs with few benefits or flexibility, many of them single moms, parents without strong support networks, they are spending significantly less goodnight moon time each day than more affluent families and less than parents in comparable positions did 30 and 40 years ago. This lost time adds up. Children build their vocabularies by listening to and interacting with their parents and caregivers. And by age 3, children from low-income families with less goodnight moon time have learned, on average, half as many words as children from middle and upper-income families, so that by the time they enter school, they have substantially smaller vocabularies than many of their classmates. Experts call this the word gap. In addition, the new brain research is showing how growing up with the stresses of poverty can damage the development of the prefrontal cortex, which is associated with the ability to pay attention, exhibit self-control, organize, and plan. Among those born in 2001, only 48% of poor children started school ready to learn, compared to 75% of children from middle-income families. And this disadvantage leads to further disparities in achievement and success over time, and even to lower earnings and lower family stability 20 and 30 years later. Now, we all agree that every child deserves the best possible chance at success in America. But we are seeing a cycle of economic pressure, and inequality that will make it harder and harder as the years go by for millions of American children to succeed in school and in life. And these children are telling us in their own ways what we need to do. Now, when I was working with the doctors at the hospital, I also volunteered at the New Haven Legal Services, and I saw a lot of real-world examples that made a big impression on me and helped me decide that I wanted to wage legal battles on behalf of poor and broken families. But person by person, family by family, it just wasn't enough. I grew up in a family that prized self-reliance. We were surrounded by friends, neighbors, church leaders, community members, all of whom really believed how important it was to support the next generation. But at the legal services office here in New Haven, I met too many people, children and adult alike, who didn't have that web of support. And it struck me that somehow we have to recreate that web. We have to be there with that concern, not just rhetorically, but in practice. Confidence in our most important institutions has fallen to historic lows. Polls show Americans losing faith in the press, in banks, in sports heroes, in religion, and of course, in Washington. Yet think about our democracy. Trust is the thread that weaves together our social fabric. The lessons that I learned here and the tools I acquired by attending law school has made me even more determined that we have to try to reverse these trends for our sake, not just the sake of those who are being left behind and left out. So at the Clinton Foundation, where I'm working with Bill and Chelsea, we're taking on this word gap. We're partnering with the Next Generation Foundation, and we've launched a campaign called Too Small to Fail. And we're going to try to use social media. We're going to try to work with businesses. We understand that we're not going to get a new program of some kind from Congress right now, but there's a lot we can do even without that and to build support and understanding of the importance. So we will be conducting public action and social media campaigns, and we will be working to try to raise the visibility of this issue. Now, when I talk about Too Small to Fail or the word gap, a lot of very well-meaning, concerned people think it's somebody else's job. I think it has to be somebody else's job. But I think it's all of our job. I think it is what we have to do now to try to reverse this tide of inequality that is eating away at the social fabric of our country. And yet, at the same time, I am confident we can. It's a serious problem with very large consequences, but it's one we know what to do to address. I remember a long conversation that I had back at Yale in the midst of all the turmoil. The world did seem to be coming apart, and kids we had grown up with were dying in Vietnam. We had the 8 Black Panthers on trial in the courthouse off the green. Thousands of angry protesters filled the streets of the city. 4 students at Kent State in May of 1970 were shot dead by National Guard troops. So it was a distressing, difficult time. But in 1970, 71, I was fortunate enough to share a dorm room with a young woman from Burma who I think is here, named Kwan Kwan Tan. She later married another classmate, Bill Wong. She was smart, she was beautiful, she was a great dancer. I had never been anywhere like Asia in my life. It seemed very far away. And I asked her, why would you come here? Why would you want to be at Yale Law School at this time? Well, she came for the same reason people still come, by the millions, and even more wanting to come, because she still saw the opportunity and the freedom, the place to get the best education in the world, or to start a business, or express an opinion, or pursue a dream. And so when I knew I was going to Burma as part of our effort to open up the country and begin a relationship, I called Kwan Kwan, and I said, what do you think? She said, it's time. It's time to go. Yes, it had been ruled by a repressive military regime, but they were reaching out, and we needed to reciprocate. One of my favorite moments was when I was speaking with one of the Burmese generals who had taken off his uniform and was now the speaker of one of the houses of parliament. And he told me, we have been studying your country, trying to understand how to run a parliament. And I was very proud to hear that. I thought maybe, you know, the law school could run some seminars or something. I said, so you've been having workshops and meeting with people. He said, oh no, we've been watching the West Wing. So we get messages out in all kinds of ways. But they looked to us as they try to make some tough decisions, and we need to know the responsibility that comes with that. We have so many blessings right now in our country, even in these difficult times. It's no surprise that students from 118 countries, more than I visited, are represented here. That's because people the world over know that Yale and America is a center for excellence and creativity. I've always felt that way. I remember a conversation with a good friend who asked me, if you could live in any country, in any century, where would it be? And people were talking about, you know, ancient Rome, Victorian England, but honestly, I said then, and I feel it just as strongly today, I would live right now in America. The chances we have to keep moving in the right direction together toward that more perfect union are even greater today than they were 40 years ago. Yes, we have big challenges ahead of us, but we have the ability, if we match it with the will, to meet every challenge we face. It will take all of us working together. It will take not only leaders, but citizens who have to dare greatly and lead boldly. But that's when we're at our best. It's in our DNA. It's what truly are the habits of the heart that de Tocqueville identified so many years ago. Yale is a place that's been around since the beginning, has seen the ups and the downs, some of which I witnessed, but keeps going from strength to strength. That's exactly like the country that has nurtured it all of these years. So I thank you, Yale, for this honor. I thank you for introducing me to the law, to many friends, to my husband. And I thank you for opening my eyes to the world around me in a way that I had never experienced, and giving me the opportunity to learn about the contributions I could make. That is the greatest gift of any education, and it is one that I hope is being seized by the students of today and tomorrow. Thank you all very much.